and welcome to the Impact Lab podcast. I am honoured, delighted, excited to have an old friend of mine as a guest, Bhavit Patel. How are you doing, Bhav?
Hi, Aziz. I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me. I feel honoured to be here, and it's nice to see you again after so long.
The honour is all mine, I can absolutely guarantee it. Right, as is tradition, at the start of this podcast, we have to do the reverse Turing test. So, Bhav, the question is, where did we first meet? So just write the answer down, and then show it to the screen. There you go.
Did we get it?
Yeah. So, if you go to the show notes, you'll be able to see the answer to the reverse Turing test and make sure that we're really human, we're not AI. Varik, how you doing, mate? It's been 12 years, can you believe that?
I'm still wrestling with the fact that it's been 12 years since you and I've had an in-person conversation. I think we've exchanged messages here and there on the digital world through LinkedIn, but I don't think we've actually spoken in 12 years. I'm still absolutely shocked it's been 12 years. Crazy, how time has flown.
It does fly far too quickly. So, tell the world what you do, Bhav.
So, my role is currently Director of Data at a company called Huel. Huel is a meal in a drink, basically. I think our founder would call it as the best plan B to a proper meal. So when you're out and about, rather than having a sandwich and a Coke and some crisps or something like that, have a Huel. So I look after the data team at Huel. We do everything from sort of like BI, data engineering, insights and analytics. I've only been there 9 weeks, so I'm still early days, but I worked with Huel last year through the consultancy I was working for, and I decided to join.
Global brand, man. Huel's it's a big deal, Huel. How did you get into the role that you do?
In general, or do you mean specifically at Huel?
No, in general.
So I think this actually, my origin story, if you will, in terms of data and analytics, actually starts at Photobox. So prior to actually being a data lead in many organizations, I actually joined Photobox in the acquisition team. So we were doing everything from, and I'm sure you remember, Aziz, from landing page testing to performance marketing. You know, we were doing SEO, display. And I was actually working with your team to build landing pages and understand how those pages were working. And then we were running A/B tests on those pages, and there wasn't actually any sort of like natural custodian of the web data. And I found myself just naturally inside that data. And I got very lucky because I think it was at that time when you guys started the incubator, which was, I forget what it's called, StickyGram or something like that. Yeah. You were looking for a head of acquisition to head up the acquisition team. And I was thinking about throwing my hat into the ring for that. But Lee Farah, if for those who remember, she was my manager / mentor at the time. She was like, Bhav, look, marketing is not your jam. You're good at it, but this is not where you thrive. And I thought this was just Lee's way of like getting me to stay in the Photobox team. And so I was like, oh, you know what? And I trusted her for some reason. And then the role came up for head of acquisition in the UK Photobox team. And I thought to myself, okay, this is it. This is what Lee's going to push me for. And she was like, nope, Bhav, this is not the one for you. I was like, come on, what's going on here? So, you know, I'm ambitious, I'm young, and I really want to be promoted. But at the time, Ollie Shears, who is the CTO of Huel now, funnily enough, he was leaving Photobox, and he was like, Bhav, this is the role you should apply for. And Lee said the same thing. She was like, Bhav, you should apply for the head of analytics role. So I was like, okay, but I do performance marketing. And they were just like, nope, you're the most data driven person in the company. And they pushed me for it, and I got it. Because I had so many people backing me, but I put my career down to luck. So my entry into the world of data and analytics was sheer luck, and actually someone else having the foresight to see that performance marketing acquisition was not the area that I was going to thrive in. I think I would have done well, but it's not what I was most passionate about. I enjoyed understanding data and looking at how users behave and what they're doing on the site, and that's how I ended up in data and analytics. And after that, it's just been a roller coaster.
It's so strange to hear you tell that story, because I was there at that time. And to this day, when I think back, I think the guy who can make the numbers make sense. It's like, that's how, even though at that time you were working in the acquisition team with Jamie, right?
Yeah.
I still think of you as the guy who could make the numbers make sense. So,
and I think the reason for that is Photobox was such an anomaly in terms of the way we operated. We had this kind of like trading way of thinking, but everything was so numerically based. And I think Jamie was looking for that when he hired me initially into the acquisition team. And I think when Lee joined, she kind of just recognized, actually, the numbers were just something I was very good at. I did my degree in maths as well. So, you know, numbers came naturally to me. I wasn't one of those natural mathematicians. You know, I don't know if when you were in school, if you remember, you had those kids that they just got it, but they couldn't explain to you why they got it. So maths never came naturally to me. I had to work hard for it. But when I got it, I understood it at a very deep level, to the point where I could explain it back to someone in a way that would make sense. And I think this is probably one of the reasons why I've felt like data has really been my home, and to be able to explain those things and understand them at such a intuitive, you know, not just an intuitive level, but just like have that deep understanding of it to the point where I can actually help people understand it and make sense of it.
Do you think that the fact that it wasn't like you weren't a savant, you know, you had to actually work to understand the processes of understanding the algorithms or whatever it was, do you think that the fact that you had to work at it allowed you to be this person who can translate the numbers to English? Like, again, I don't want to oversimplify your role, right? But that's always how I viewed you, as someone who's just exceptionally articulate when in terms of converting numbers into genuine insights.
I think this comes from, so had I gone straight into data, there is every likelihood that I may not have been able to do that. It's because I started in performance marketing and I got to understand actually the problems that commercial teams face, like, you know, the challenges you are facing, the challenges that our trading team are facing. And when you work in those areas, you start to understand the nuances of what you try to do, because you were in product, right? You, Luca, Isha, you guys were trying to improve the customer experience when users came to the site. Glenn and the trading team were trying to make the numbers work and hit our commercial numbers. And Jamie and me and Roy and the team were trying to grow our base from an acquisition perspective and retention perspective. And when all of those pieces work closely together, you start having context. And actually, I think context is a big part of what makes data, or what makes a data team successful in any organization. If the data team is so removed from the context what's happening, you can't do that. And I think, so this is one of the reasons why I think when you say, like, Vav, you can translate numbers into insights, it's because I've been on the receiving end of the data of, like, okay, well, what do we want to do? Well, we know these are the challenges we're facing. How do we use data to make sense of this, and where do we go from here?
It was a university box, wasn't it?
PhotoBox was 100% university. I think we all grew and developed, and we all faced those challenges day in and day out together in that small little office in Paddington.
Yeah, it was relentless. I've tried to replicate that environment in so many different places, but I've never been able to, because it was just absolutely relentless, non-stop, breakneck speed. And the things we did were actually like career highlights to this day, I think.
Yeah, me too. I for me as well. I still look back very fondly at those days, and I'm so grateful that I got a chance to work with everyone. And I think what was great about the PhotoBox culture, and again, you know, I don't want to take full credit for all of my sort of like success I've had in my career, because it wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for the people around me at PhotoBox. And that dynamic that we had of people who are really passionate about what we do in our disciplines, but also about the product, I think that kind of like perfect balance. And then this is for me, actually, I talk about the DNA of a company. I've been fortunate. I've been able to work in companies which share that similar PhotoBox DNA a few times now. So PhotoBox obviously was the first time I ever experienced. And from that point onwards, I kind of knew what great looked like in any organization. I suddenly had a bar of what an amazing culture looked like. And then I got to see it again when I joined Moo, because if you remember Marta, she was our engineering director at PhotoBox. She joined and left and went and joined Moo. And she was like, Bav, hey, we're looking for a head of product analytics. Do you want to come and join? So I did. And that was great. So I got to work with Marta there. And then when I left Moo, I got to work at Gusto. Again, very similar DNA. Founder-led, amazing product that people love, people who are passionate. And then I was able to, like, you know, by this point, my network's growing. So I was able to find great people in my life that I could bring in. And then Huel follows that same DNA. Founder-led. I'm working with Ollie again. And it's a product that I love. I've been a customer since 2019. The people who work there love it as well. It shares that kind of like similar DNA, fast pace. Everyone's trying to do like amazing work. And so I don't know. I now know what I want in a company. And I think it's, and it wouldn't, and I know, I only know that now because I was fortunate enough to work at PhotoBox. So I put so much of my career down to luck, to working with people like you, to Lee's foresight of saying, Bav, nope, don't go in acquisition, stay here. When the right role comes, I promise I will support you, and just being able to trust her, and I did. If I hadn't, who knows, I wouldn't have been in data.
Yeah, shout out to the guys at PhotoBox, man, Lawrence and Stan and Sebastian and all of those guys.
I saw Stan yesterday. Stan is a he's on the board at Huel, and I was leaving the office, and I just happened to see this very elegant man standing there, and I couldn't help but take a photo. So there's me and Stan.
There he is, literally yesterday. He's literally not changed a bit. That is ridiculous.
Stan has not changed either. So he was literally outside because he's on the board there. So I ran into him. That photo was yesterday.
Fabulous. Say hi to him if you see him again. Bav, do you use AI?
Do I use AI? I do use AI. I'd be foolish not to use AI. I think we have to embrace it. It is what it is.
Yeah.
I think there's a debate whether I am AI. So I think you started that debate. If I'm being completely honest, Aziz.
So, I don't think there's any way that you can't use AI at the minute, but what do you use and what do you use it for?
So, I can put it really simply. I use AI as a sparring partner because I think there is this... And the future, I don't know what 5 years, 10 years will look like down the road. I know for now, AI is great if you know what you're doing. And I think it creates this sort of false confidence if you don't know what you're doing. And if you're asking AI to just do things that you don't know how to do yourself... I think there is a misuse of AI. So for me, AI is a sparring partner. I use it when I'm stuck on a problem. I've explored the problem. I now need a second pair of eyes. And AI for me acts as someone who I can go to straight away rather than having to book a meeting or something. I'm just like, look, this is the problem I'm working on. Like, help me, critique my work, or how else would you approach this? And so I use it as a sparring partner. I'm actually also using it as a way to help me do a course. I'm doing a course on econometrics right now. So I'm doing some hardcore maths, and the underlying formulas are sometimes really hard to learn out of a textbook or I'm actually doing an online course through, and I'm reading it. So I'm having to read tons and tons of formulas. And sometimes it takes a long time to kind of like, oh my God, what do these formulas mean? What is sigma? What is alpha? What is, this weird symbol here that, oh, it means independent of. And so being able to have AI as kind of like a tutor to be able to at the same time also put some of those things into a bit more layman's term has actually been really helpful for me to get through. So I would say sparring partner / teacher / just colleague.
Yeah. I love that term as a sparring partner. I think that's exactly... So the genesis of the Impact Lab is really trying to solve the problem that you articulated there, which is that... So for you and I, so let's say that there is there's the pre-internet era, there's the internet era, then there's the AI era. So I straddle all three. I think you might have straddled all three as well.
I do.
And so we have that foundational understanding, that foundational knowledge of our discipline, in my case marketing, in your case data and BI. And so we can use AI as a sparring partner. And I think that there is a trap that a lot of marketers are falling into where they aren't using it as a sparring partner. They're using it as the role that they should be doing. They don't actually understand the outputs that are coming, and therefore they can't actually create value through the use of AI. And I think that one of the things that I'm really passionate about is getting that base level understanding there to allow people. So if we carry on the boxing analogy, because I'm a big fan of boxing, it's essentially...
Sorry, fun fact, Aziz, I started boxing 1 year ago to help me turn my life around from a health perspective. So,
how could
I know you're a boxer. If I don't do boxing, so I train twice a week. If I don't have my sessions now, I feel like I need that space. I need that release.
Yeah, same, man. Absolutely the same. Shout out Spartan Boxing Club. So it's essentially if you try and spar someone who's just way better than you, then that's not, you don't learn anything in that process. You only learn pain. Whereas if you're sparring someone who's at a similar level to you, you get to improve, and they improve at the same time. And I think that that's the kind of symbiotic relationship that works with AI. Sadly, in the marketing agency world, there are just so many AI agencies now that it's very difficult to see where the value is coming from. But on a day-to-day level, how do you think that AI's changed your role, or not necessarily just you specifically? Think about the people who maybe work for you or the level below you. Okay, time for a message from this episode's sponsor. At the Impact Lab, we believe in building businesses that truly pack a punch. Businesses with real impact. That's why I'm excited to talk to you about Spartans Boxing Club. More than just a workout, Spartans Boxing has built a powerful brand around discipline and, most importantly, community. They have transformed the fitness space. They're expanding rapidly from their Dubai base and are now seeking passionate franchisees across the GCC. If you're an entrepreneur ready to own a high-energy, proven business with real growth potential, explore Spartans Boxing Club. Their franchisee offers are incredible, so ignite your entrepreneurial journey today. The link is in the show notes. All right, back to the show.
So, actually, we've really embraced AI. You might have seen some of Ollie's LinkedIn posts. We're on ChatGPT Enterprise. We're really trying to make AI be a part of our culture and help people grow and develop and try new things and work at speed. And I think, you know, one way to think about it is, because I think there's that fear around, and so I'm going off tangent. I will come back to your question, but I'm going off tangent on the question because there is that underlying fear that AI is going to replace all of our jobs, right? And I hear this so much. I was at a conference last week, and there was this full-scale debate about whether or not AI is going to replace, especially in the agency world thing and what have you, because there was a lot of agencies, and I was talking to them, especially having just left consultancy side, Lean Convert, shout out to you guys. There was this fear that it's going to take jobs and people won't be needed. And I disagree. I think what AI does and how people should be thinking about it is not so much that it's going to replace you. I think AI will improve productivity. And this is how we're embracing Azure. It will improve productivity, which means that you can scale your revenue faster than you scale your headcount, which means your actual revenue per head coming into your organization, AI should help you grow that without having to historically, you know, if you wanted to grow your revenue, you also have to grow your headcount to go with it. I think what AI allows us to do and what the way agencies should be thinking about it is not so much that it's going to replace you or it should do your job for you. No, it should help you be productive in areas where there's currently waste, which means that when you reduce that waste, your productivity goes up. Therefore, the revenue per head in your organization should go up. And this should come at without sacrificing jobs. You can still grow, but it's efficiency. So how do we use it? How do I use it? It's in this similar way. The way that we've adopted AI is not to replace us. It's to help us reduce waste in our organization so that we can continue to work at speed. A lot of Huel's culture, it's in the DNA, is hustle hard, work fast, you know, like that speed element of it. Because it's, you know, especially in a brand like Huel, where we've created a market as a for a product, speed is going to be the most important thing. And I think we have to be a living embodiment of that. And AI helps us now do that. Okay, 5 years ago, we couldn't. You wouldn't have been able to do that. There would have been other things. Now AI just helps us do that. So for me, how I use it on a day-to-day basis, it's still sparring. I still use the term sparring partner. It's a big part of it. But it just allows me to get somewhere faster now than I would have 3 years ago, 4 years ago.
Fair enough. And again, I'm in a very similar space at our agency where we're OpenAI Enterprise users too, and one of the things that that I found is that it's essentially a support structure to your muscles. It's like you essentially feel like you've got a superpower. You can be so much more effective. You can do so much more work. Like I think about some of the tasks that I personally had to do on a day-to-day basis. And they would take days, weeks sometimes to do these tasks. And now you can kind of get those donkey work tasks out of the way through AI. So what kind of if there's someone who's listening who's early in their data career, what are the kind of day-to-day tasks that you just feel like, okay, I can outsource that if you like to AI versus the tasks that you're like, no, hold on, this needs a human eye?
So the way that I use it is, certainly from a written perspective, I feel like certainly in the analytics space and the data space, we'll spend all of our time looking through the data. But once you've kind of got that data, to be able to synthesize the findings into a white paper or a presentation or something like that, that's the AI part. So I'll do the legwork on the analysis, find my insights, and then I can feed it into our ChatGPT and then just say, look, this is what I was trying to do. This was the problem statement. Help me quickly structure a presentation or written, you know, the written output of this analysis. And then, but that's again, it's just the middle step. It's like the editor when you're writing the book. I'm still writing the book, but the editor is helping me just like fine tune and refine, like the, you know, help me correct the grammar and help spelling mistakes. So for me, it's really around getting, I still do the writing the book. The AI part is the editor and help me kind of clean it and chop it up. And then I do one final pass. I like, actually, you know, I don't quite like that. This is, it's taken out some of the authenticity in my approach. You know, I like to still keep things human, even if I have got an AI element. And so I would say writing is a big part, but this is where I would err on the side of caution. As you know, I like to write like on LinkedIn and I publish like blog posts and things like that. AI is not the starting point for those type of pieces of work. This is my written post on something like LinkedIn is a stream of my consciousness written in my authentic tone of voice. But where I get AI involved again is that editor phase, which is like, hey, look, just help me edit this. Like, and I'll be really strict with AI. I'm like, look, don't rewrite this. Keep the authenticity of my voice, but just maybe help me make some of the sentences a bit punchy or something like that. I actually joined a writing club 5 years ago because I knew that writing was something I wanted to pursue. So I would write, and then I would put it into this Slack group. It was a paid community. I put it into a Slack group and I'd have professional writers like feed into it and like give me feedback. They weren't subject matter experts. They didn't need to be. They would just read what I was writing and say, hey, Bav, like this is the area how, you know, you should rephrase this. You've got a passive voice here. Try to be a bit more like, you know, forthright. Try to remove some of these kind of like non-words. Be a bit more forthright in sort of like and confident in your writing. So that helped me develop my writing style. And then now I use AI just as those guys that I don't, I you know, I'm not part of the community anymore, but that's how I use it. But for my written pieces in the office, at work, I do the analysis myself. If I'm struggling, I might get AI to like quickly just run some code for me where I can't be bothered to write R. And just say, look here, like quickly pull, write me a script that's doing this. But I fed it enough context for it to get it right. Yeah. And even then, I'm still like double checking the script.
Yeah, and so LinkedIn is such an interesting platform because your content is very obviously human content. Like it's very obviously Babic who's writing what he's writing. And I think that the channel itself is just so filled with people who don't know how to use AI, using AI to write some random idea. And I always say that like once upon a time, content was king. It's a commodity now, and the more people do that, the less value that that content has. But at the same time, the more value authentic content like yours and things like this does have. So it's like we're in this sort of weird thing. Bav, before you mentioned that you're studying econometrics, is that right? What is that?
So it's a field. It's a subset of a field of like economics. So when we think about, and let me put it in, rather than try to explain like some academic term, like definition of it, I'm going to just maybe put it into a bit more real time. So with the growing privacy changes that are happening sort of like in the media landscape, in the digital landscape, with cookie consent, GDPR, all these kind of things, it's harder and harder to get that kind of like one-to-one where someone came from, where spenders have, you know, where you spent that £1, how much actually came back, because you lose some of that just through sort of like that signal loss that we get in tag managers or Facebook pixels, something like that. Because you're in the agency world, right? So you guys are probably finding it harder and harder to be able to attribute spend directly to your marketing campaigns because of that loss. And I think at the moment, it's probably, certainly in the UK, I estimate it's about 30% loss. But that's not all your marketing is doing. So let's say, for example, you're one of your brands. I don't know who your clients are, but let's say one of your clients has a digital presence and they have an in-store presence. So they've got D2C and they've also got sort of like a physical in-store presence. Your marketing isn't just driving your D2C, your e-commerce business. It's also driving other parts of your brand. Now, it's hard to gauge that because footfall into store can't be directly attributed to a click or an impression. So we use econometric modeling to be able to say, actually, how much, you know, we've just done this big TV campaign or we've just done this massive reach campaign on Facebook. What value did that drive beyond just site impressions? And one way to come to answer that question is through econometric modeling, right? And so that's one use case. And this is, you know, you've heard the word MMM, I'm sure, before, like mixed media modeling or, you know, mixed marketing modeling, whatever. that's one element. That's one part of it. There's also things like, let's say, for example, you want to run an experiment, but you can't run an experiment purely because of the, you know, like maybe some challenges, like, you know, your brand is quite social and everyone's it's quite active, and, you know, you do this big thing, but you can't give it to half because the other half will find out anyway. And sometimes companies just don't want to work on an experiment basis, right? I am very pro-experimentation, running A-B tests, but I do understand that that's just not a reality. So you could use econometric modeling to be able to understand causality. Let's say, for example, you're about to launch a feature in Egypt, right? And you want to see how that's going to do. You can't run it as an A-B test. It has to be launched to everyone. But you need to be able to measure uplift. So the one way to go about potentially doing that is to create a synthetic Egypt. So you look at the other regions that you're in. So you could look at Egypt, Dubai, you know, UAE, whatever it might be. And you build a market that looks like Egypt. So you launch in Egypt and then you compare it against these other markets. And that gives you kind of like a synthetic Egypt group that you can basically answer the question of what would have happened if we didn't launch this. And it's that synthetic market becomes your counterfactual. So that's what econometrics. So I understand it. I just wanted to formalize my knowledge into a bit more into like what's under the hood. Like, I'm more than happy to drive a self-driving car if I know how it works. And it's, you know, it's not easy, because if I just I have my notebook here. This is the type of stuff that I'm kind of like having to, and I'm going back to like proper old school notebook. This is how I do writing my courses. I'm like, okay, I need to remember this formula. What does this formula do? This is the expected value. This is da 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 da. All these kind of things. So, yeah, that's what econometrics is.
I guess there's so many use cases beyond the commercial use cases. I'm talking about like at a policy level. You know, what are the impact of certain drugs on different types of populations? What are the impacts of this nudge that we do in schools at age 8? You know, I guess that there are so many different variables, because we're so beholden to just the narrative that we're told. And like, I guess it's probably the photobox days that taught us this. The numbers are the things that don't lie, and we kind of need the underlying data.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of this stuff it's not new maths, right? This is all derived from economic policies that proper economists have done and studied for, like, you know, like 80, 90 years. So it's nothing new. And this goes back to, I use AI as a sparring partner, right? I could quite easily feed this into AI and say, hey, just answer this question for me. But I don't know what it's doing, right? I can't look inside the hood. So when it turns around and says, oh, we used this, you know, difference in difference model, or we did this via some matched market testing, I need to understand what that's happened, you know, what that's doing and how it's working, so that I can understand. Okay, cool. Now I understand it. I'm happy for you to go and automate this and do this on a regular basis.
Love that. Love that. All right, Bav, you're a very humble person, so I'm going to ask you a question. You're not going to like it because you're humble. But you have had, and you continue to have an incredibly like successful career. So, look, talk to the people who are in their early 20s. What are the three things that you do that they should be doing to help drive their career forward? It doesn't necessarily need to be in BI and analytics.
Oh, you got me with this question. Okay, three things. One, get out there and speak to people. I know the concept of networking seems so wanky. And I honestly was really anti-networking. And it's how I started my event, Crap Talks, because I went to this one event and I really hated it. I think it was like Marketing Week Live or some trash like that. I can't remember exactly what it was. And I remember it was a 5-day event. I picked the day that was the day today. So every day is something like we have marketing, CRM, blah, blah, blah. There was one that was dedicated to data. And I remember going in, you know, I took a day out of my calendar, and we all know that everyone's really busy right now. So to take a full day out of your working week to go to a conference is a big, like, this is me taking a risk on the organizers and the event. And I remember the first talk was a fireside chat, and in the audience was a manager's manager. I didn't even know they were going to be there. And I was like, sat there, I was like, this guy's an idiot. Why is he on this panel? He knows nothing about data. And there was like, and I found out very quickly, the other two people on that panel were equally not qualified to be there. And so I got really annoyed, and that's how I started Crap Talks. And anyway, I'm a long way of saying, go to events, right? Meet people, understand what people are saying, right? But don't go to events which have people who with fancy job titles. When you have an event that's focused on sponsors and fancy job titles, I guarantee you the quality of the content will be suboptimal. And certainly it won't be for you. So get out there, meet people, but go to conferences that are full of practitioners at your level, especially if you're not quite in a leadership phase. That's the first one. Second part, context. Understand the context of your company. Understand how your company makes money, right? If you do not understand the unit economics of your company, it's really hard for you to be able to tie what you're doing to some type of intrinsic value. Now, I know value comes in many ways, right? Revenue, things like that, of course. But you need to understand, at the end of the day, everyone's there. These companies are there to grow revenue. You know, they're supporting so many people in the company. You know, like, people's livelihoods depend on it. Customers love it. If you don't understand the model, it's really hard for you to influence it. So, and this is true whether you're a data person or not. I always say, when you join a new company, the first people you should meet are your finance team. Go and speak to finance and understand, how do we as a company make money? So that's two. Three. Oh, see, this is really hard. There's like 50 things I could think of, so I'm trying to be really selective.
You can have more if you want more than three.
No, I want to keep it punchy. I'm not very good at keeping it punchy, clearly. I would say the third one, there's many things. I would say write more. I would say develop critical thinking. And again, this is true of whether you're a data person or not, because I'm a terrible public speaker. This sounds, people are always surprised when I say this. I'm nervous, I get shaky, and my voice starts to crack a little bit, and I and I stutter. So writing for me helps me articulate my thoughts. And by writing something down, I basically load up pre-written sentences in my head that I'm able to regurgitate. That makes it sound like I've got a conscious stream of thoughts that are really well articulated. It's not. I've just written about it so much and I've read about it so much that I can, when it comes to it's certainly in my world, I can talk very elegantly about my discipline. If you ask me to talk about something I'm not that well knowledgeable about, I'm going to sound like an idiot. So I would say that would be the third thing. I would say write more. I'm sure there's more, but I would say write more, document your thoughts. That will help you get clarity. Once you've got clarity, you're able to get buy-in. Once you've got buy-in, honestly, you'll be unstoppable.
And they're the three things that you've done in your career, right? They're the things that have helped you kind of evolve in your career.
Yeah, I'm sure there's more things, but I think those are the things for me that I can call out. Meet people, go out and get there. Go and learn what's happening in the world. Understand the revenue and the economics of your company, because then you can tie your work to some value. And three, write more to offer clarity. And it develops critical thinking.
Brilliant. So a large part of the point of the Impact Lab is the Pareto principle, right? So this is absolutely true in marketing. I see this every single month when I see all the client reports. I'm like, guys, can't you see that just three things that you did drove 90% of the value for this company? So let's just do those three things over and over again. And of course, in marketing, there is a kind of a limited number of channels or content types or things or activities that you can do. Whereas in your world, there's kind of an unlimited amount of data that can be measured, tracked, and understood. So I guess getting to the Pareto principle for you is even more difficult. It's not fair for me to ask what are the top metrics that you follow. I think what's probably more valuable is, if you're a new person going into a company, how can you best understand what are the metrics that actually drive that organization forward?
I mean, when I say go speak to your finance team, right? And understand your revenue model, the finance team will give you the financial layer. It's then up to you to then go take that. Imagine, think of it as a tree, revenue, right? Revenue is made up of customers, orders times AOV, for example, right? Your customers are made up of, your orders are made up of your customers times the average order frequency, right? Your average order frequency is made up of your blah, 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 right? Your customers are made up your site traffic times your conversion rate. Your conversion rate is made up of, and you can go down to this first principles thinking. So it's hard to say what are the right metrics for any one person, because a product team, let's say you're a product manager who looks after the discovery part of your e-commerce site. your set of metrics are going to be really different to, say, for example, someone who works in the acquisition space, whose job is to get sign up or to get eyeballs or to get people come to the site. And the value for the two things will be tied together somehow in this kind of like unit economic tree of your overall company revenue model, but you will both be looking at it from a slightly different lens. So I think it's, if you know, if you are in a company where, you know, like, hey, Bab, look, I'm not the director of data. I only work in this one thing. That's okay. Go and find out what your North Star is for your area. And that could be something like your acquisition rate. It could be something like your add to cart rate. It could be something like, you know, I don't even know. Like, there's so many business models out there.
Yeah.
But I think one thing I think about, you know, you mentioned the Pareto principle. And actually, I don't like quoting Jeff Bezos. He's a smart guy, but he's also a multi-billionaire. And, you know, it's easy to quote, you know, like people who are like super rich. But he has this one, I watched this one interview with him. And he said this one thing, and it's changed my life and it's changed my thinking a lot. And the entire Amazon model is not around like what's going to change, right? It's easy. So, oh, AI is coming. We should do this thing with AI. And no one knows what AI is going to do in like 5 years from now, right? Or 3 years from now, right? And this is kind of like a systemic problem in an organization. Like, we see these shiny things happen. Like, oh, mobile, we need apps. No, we don't need apps. Let's stop and think for a second, right? We go and chase these things because we're all so worried about the unknown. Like, oh, what if we get left behind? And that's not to say you shouldn't think about that, right? Like, Blockbuster is a classic example of a company who didn't think about the unknown. But there is also a part of the problem, which is the known, which is what's not going to change. And I really like this thing that Jeff Bezos says, like, the entire or a large part of the Amazon model is built around what's not going to change 5 years from now. Well, we know that 5 years from now, people are still going to want cheap products, right? Like affordable products that are like competitively priced. They're still going to want fast delivery. They're still going to want like world-class customer service. From their AWS point, they're still going to want to grow data and have like an affordable, scalable, cloud-based data warehouse system. These things are not going to change ever. Some of the underlying mechanics might change of how we deliver, da, 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 all those things. But those core fundamental principles are not going to change. And I think this is true even in your role, right? If I think about what's not going to change for me as a data lead at a company like you, well, people are still going to want insights. They're still going to want insights yesterday. They're still going to want to be able to do certain things in a certain way. Da, da, da. And it's about matching those expectations with the work we do and the way that my team operate. So that's how I would think about it.
Love it. You know, you operate in a world where, I guess, you know, on a day-to-day basis, people are trying to convince you that some metric is more important than another metric, and mostly people who are non-practitioners because they read a white paper or they heard something from Mark Zuckerberg or something. What do you think is the most, and this is a really difficult question, right, because but let's just focus on companies that are predominantly e-commerce businesses. What do you think is like the most misunderstood KPI in the field?
You've got me here, Aziz. You know, I'm going to go with an obvious one, and I'm going to say conversion rate, because it's the one that people sort of like hang their hat on. And what they don't understand is that, that's not what they don't understand. I think they do understand it, but people often forget, is, and in the back of my brain, I'm going to think of a better metric. But I'm going to lead with conversion rate, because conversion rate is a metric that can be artificially inflated by just doing less of something. It doesn't mean that you've driven your commercials forward, right? Let's say, I'll give an example. I used to work for Gusto, which is a mailbox subscription service. And the primary metric there was conversion rate. I actually wrote a paper about this, so you can find it on my Medium. And the primary metric there was conversion rate. But Gusto's business model, and any subscription model for that matter, is based on two factors. The conversion, so the conversion to their first purchase, so your breadth, how many people buy, but then also the depth, which is how frequently do they come back and place that order. Now, when you focus on just conversion rate, there is this risk that you will flood your customer base with low value customers through really cheap acquisition offers, like, hey, get your first box free, da, 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 da. It grows that top, you know, it grows that kind of like very surface level base conversion number, but your depth metric suffers because then you're not getting high quality traffic and you're focused on acquiring customers at all costs. And this is, I genuinely believe, one of the big parts of So we're currently going through this very deep, like, tech layoffs thing. And again, I wrote a piece around sort of like my views on like why we've had this massive tech layoff. And I think what happens is like there's this too much like grow at all costs, like this unsustainable, very toxic, like growing at all costs mentality. And that comes at sustainable growth. That comes at the cost of sustainable growth. So when you have a metric like conversion rate, which is like, let's get numbers, you forget about the quality of those customers. You forget to treat those customers well. You forget to give them a good service. You forget to give them products that they love and the experience that they're gonna they're gonna want. And because you're always chasing that conversion metric. So I would say, and actually having now said it out loud, I've switched off the part of my brain that was thinking of another metric. I would say conversion rate, because it's a metric that does say a lot about your business, but it's also one that can be easily and artificially inflated through like switching off your poorest traffic. You know, you might be missing incremental because you're so bothered, you know, because you're so concerned about conversion rate going down that you think, oh, well, let's switch off this channel that's incremental, but it's cheap, right? And on the flip side, you know, you might be driving, you know, and I guess in a similar vein, CPA might be something that's really overly inflated. You know, you could argue the same thing where you're focusing on customers because CPA is really high, but it's high because those are high value customers.
Understand
your unit economics.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with your sort of description of why conversion rate can be so misleading. Like, I always say that a disaggregated conversion rate is the only useful conversion rate, because ultimately a single top line conversion rate trending over time, any variability can be to do with any myriad of factors. You could have switched off your display channel. You could have, you know, you could have had an acquisition offer. Anything could have happened. So unless you've got it totally disaggregated, every individual channel, and that's the only way it becomes useful. So I actually completely agree with you. Bav, I don't want to hold you too long. Just one big area that I did want to sort of focus on a little bit is, you mentioned before crap talks. As soon as I saw, by the way, that you named it Crap Talks, I was like, yep, that's bad.
that was Ollie Shears. So I actually called it Conversion Rate, Optimization, Analytics, and Product, because it's a cross-discipline meetup community I started. We don't work in silos, so why have these big siloed events? And Ollie's like, Bab, drop the O and just call it crap. I was like, yeah, that's a great idea. Cool. Yep. And somehow it's stuck. And now my legacy to my children is, if you search Bhavik Patel on Google, you get all sorts of results. But if you type Bhavik Patel crap, that's all me, baby.
So, like, in a world where, you know, AI is shaping so much, how do you think, like, face-to-face interactions like crap talks add to people's careers?
I think if we think about knowledge as very academic, but also worldly, right? I think it's easy to sit in front of your computer and gain the academic knowledge needed to do your job better or understand some concepts that allow you to do, you know, your role in a better way. That's great. But there is the other side of knowledge, which is how worldly are you? And I think, you know, your ability to develop that worldliness, I don't even know if that's a proper word, only comes from hearing thoughts from different people. Like that diversity of thought from different people, from people from different backgrounds, different experiences, different stages, different personal traits. I'm sorry, I just don't think you can replicate that through AI or anything like that. People's lived experiences are what create connections. I think it's how, you know, like I genuinely believe if I was a very, you know, head down, not out there person, you and I wouldn't be on this call because you wouldn't see half my trash on LinkedIn, right? And you're like, oh, actually, you know, maybe Bav would be someone to, you know, for better or worse, invite onto a podcast. So I think it's that worldliness element. And again, sorry, I don't have a better word for it. I need to find a word for it but that's the only thing I can, that's the only word that comes to mind.
That's right. It's like worldliness, maturity, self-awareness, all of these things that, you know, I think that I completely agree before, by the way, when you said, you know, be selective in the types of events that you go to. I totally agree. I get way more value out of like meetup events, small, very specific events than these large, huge conferences. I get very, very little value out of them. Unless I'm talking at those very large conferences, then I get customers out of them. But other than that, as an attendee, I don't really get any value from it. Last question, Bav.
Yeah.
Bit of a curveball, all right? What's something that you've changed in the last, that you've changed your mind about in the last 12 months? Doesn't have to be to do with work.
Okay, if it doesn't have to be to do with work. I never really appreciated boxing as a sport. So all my friends, like growing through uni, my mates would be like, oh, you know, there's a big fight on. But it's always like some stupid hour, like 2 a.m. because it's in Las Vegas, right? And I never really appreciated boxing. And about a year ago, well, about 18 months ago, I was in hospital because I had this thing, and I ended up in hospital for about 3 weeks. And coming out of hospital, I already had high blood pressure, and I've got two kids, so it's super stressful. But then they also told me that they were like, Bav, you're kind of like crossed over into diabetic range. So I was like, no, I've got high blood pressure. I refuse to be labeled a diabetic as well. So I was like, I need to find something that I can do, that I can enjoy. I'm not big on gym classes. When I was younger, I used to do martial arts. Both my boys do taekwondo, and I take them every week. And I'm excited, you know, in some ways, I look up to my children, which is a really weird thing to say, but I they inspire me to be better. So 12 months ago to the date, 2 weeks ago, I decided to take up boxing, and it has changed my view of many things because I've started to understand why it's called the sweet science. I never understood why it's called the sweet science. And so I think I've changed my mind about boxing, and not just about boxing, but about the boxing community, because I never gave it much thought. So I would say rather it's not so much I've changed my mind about, but more I've developed an opinion about and the importance and value it adds, because the boxing community I'm part of, it's like a sad men's club, but we have our sort of like group, and we all celebrate and share each other, share success stories. There's a lot of banter in there as well, but I've realized that there is a real community element about boxing. And I don't know, maybe it's just who I am. I like communities, whether it's crap talks, whether it's boxing, whether it's writing communities. I find communities is not just, you know, important for me, but I think it's the heart of culture, small communities. And, you know, this is how like tribes and stuff were formed, right? They were small communities. I don't know. I mean, it's not even my revelation is not even groundbreaking, right? This is like hundreds and hundreds of years of... yeah, maybe, but maybe it's groundbreaking in the age of AI.
Yeah, it is. And not just AI, in the digital age. You know that obviously I have a relationship with Spartans Boxing Club, and we discuss this all the time. Like, community is the glue that sticks so much together, and it is, you know, anthropologically, it's how we formed our own societies. It's how we've gotten to where we are. So, I completely agree. I was in a very similar position before I took up boxing, and I always say boxing is more akin to art than to chess. Like it is so cerebral. People can't understand when you say that. You have to get in a ring to understand why it's so cerebral. Yeah. You get tired in one round, not physically, mentally. I love it, Bavik. I thank you so much.
And actually,
go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to add just, you know, to your question, like what something has changed. I think this has changed the way I consume social media as well, because I now consume social media from the views of finding communities of things I'm interested in. So I do a lot of artwork. So I have a small private Instagram account, which I just follow local artists and like artists, you know, like in the UK. And that just keeps me like seeing what's happening. Boxing, again, I have a small boxing. I just follow Instagram boxers. I have another account for that. So rather than having this one account where I don't follow any of my friends and family. It's for me, it's just about finding community. So I guess that's the thing that's changed, is I've started to embrace social media, but in a way that's very different. Like, you know, 10, 15 years ago when Facebook came about, it was there to connect people. I think it started off that way, but then it became this like really creepy, like, oh, let's see what this person's doing from like 20 years ago that I've not seen. And then I suddenly found like, whoa. And then when Elon Musk bought Twitter, I was like, that's it, see ya, I'm off. And then I've just rediscovered it through sort of like small community-based stuff. So I guess that's what's changed. Sorry, I know we were wrapping up there.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Pap. So people will put in the show notes your LinkedIn and your Medium. You've got a Medium page as well, so we'll pop that in the show notes. Really appreciate your time. People will definitely get a lot from the words that you've had to say. Thank you guys for listening, and I'll see you on the next Impact Lab podcast. All right, before you go, just a quick message from me. Thank you for listening to the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope it made you think, maybe change your mind on a few things. If you want to reach out to us, my email and all of the links are in the show notes. Please do reach out to us. We'd love to hear from you. Please take a moment wherever you heard this podcast, please leave us a 5-star review. I'd really appreciate it. It really helps get the podcast up and out into other people so that other people can benefit from the work that we're doing. I'd really appreciate it if you took a minute just to do that. I wanted to share with you a couple of things just before we go in the last 30 seconds. The first thing is that, you know, the Impact Lab .store is where we have all of our courses. We've got a free course called the AI Trap. It's a free course designed to make sure that AI becomes your superpower and not your crutch. It's for anyone that's using AI and to help you really get an understanding of how to build your own core foundational competencies whilst using AI at the same time. There's also a paid course up there at the moment, which is the Impact Marketing System. This is our flagship course. If you are in marketing or if you are in business development or if you've got your own business, you really got to understand the foundations of what makes an impact in marketing and what are the core tenets of things that you need to do. The Impact Marketing System is the system that I have trained for over 10 years to get people from basically very novice marketers to become world-class marketers. And there are people all around the world, thousands of people who have done this course working at massive organizations or running their own very successful businesses, in part because of the things that they've learned through the Impact Marketing System. So please take the time to visit theimpactlab.store. If you're a brand in the GCC and you're looking for a digital marketing agency that'll cut through the noise and make a real impact on your business, then Kush Digital is your man. Go to kush.digital or you can email the team at contact@kush.digital. Kush is with the C, C-U-S-H, .digital. Digital marketing, that makes an impact. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Don't forget to leave that review. Thanks a lot. See you at the next episode.